Accession number 10599, Rule 24.
Will you continue with the Geel attack, please, Major?
So it seemed that the German attack on the bridge had failed, but the 60 Ally had been driven out in Geel, and B and my company, D Company, were ordered to relieve them. And they moved up and relieved the 60 Ally by about 10 o'clock. With D Company, there was an anti-tank gun commanded by a Corporal Boyle from the anti-tank platoon, and he had a Bren gun, and the men had rifles, of course, and we were being inconvenienced, to put it mildly, by some German snipers, and they, Corporal Boyle and his chaps, started to hunt these men out and eventually managed to wound or kill these snipers, because anyway the fire stopped and they weren't bothered anymore. Shelling was still pretty considerable, and a fairly big shell landed just behind me, and I got quite a lot of shrapnel in the back and so on, and that really was the last that part of that battle that I just took any active part in, and anyway I was able to walk back to the RAP and then evacuated from there. Just to finish the story, we managed to hold on to our positions in Geel, and the bridge had gradually thickened up. Then the brigade was relieved by the 6th Royal Scots Fusiliers from the 15th Scottish Division, and that was the last bit of fighting that the battalion in that particular area around Geel. Well, I was in Brussels and then put on an air ambulance, and I think within less than 36 hours I was back in UK, and was taken to Burntwood Hospital, which was an emergency hospital at Lichfield. I was there for, I don't know, about two or three weeks perhaps. My wounds weren't very bad, really. And then, after a short bit of leave, I was on the 4th of November posted to the 6 North Staffs, at that time in Sussex. They were a battalion. After two or three weeks there, I was told that I had to command a detached company, which was made up of some Durhams, some North Staffs and South Staffs, many of whom had been in Burma with the Chindits. Anyway, our task was to go to a place called Chartridge, which was 2 or 3 miles from Chesham in Buckinghamshire. And the object of this Chartridge company was to act as a reinforcement to the Guards company, I think it was, who were protecting Chequers. And it had been thought that the Germans might well mount a parachute attack on Chequers when the Prime Minister was there. And if that had happened, we were to move to go to the help of the Chequers garrison. We were there for over Christmas. The Prime Minister was most weekend when he could, and therefore we were always at full strength at weekends. But they had a day off during the week. Got a sort of moonlighting job in a brewery in nearby Amersham, I think. It wasn't a very easy period, really. Most of the chaps had been seen active service and were not very keen about training. We made it as interesting as we could, and we had quite a bit of sport, football and that sort of thing. Anyway, while I was there, the majority of the 50th Division and certainly the DLI Brigade came back from Holland, where they'd moved to on the Nijmegen Island. And on by the 14th of December, they were back in the United Kingdom. Well, by the 22nd of February, I had been posted back to 8 DLI, which was then at Keighley. And the task there was to retrain RASC drivers as infantrymen. The personnel that 21st Army Group were getting more short of than anything was infantrymen, particularly infantry officers. And the wastage from the Normandy fighting and through, and also particularly around in Holland and so on, had been considerable. And they must have more infantry, so the RASC drivers were trained as infantrymen. Not that they liked it much, but that was the job, and we got on with it. I think a few weeks later on, the last draft we had really had the last laugh on us, because the fighting had then got mobile again, and the thing they were short of then was lorry drivers. So they went back to the Cont lorry drivers. Celebrated VE Day with a big parade in Keighley, the laying of wreaths and so on. And then in mid-October, the battalion moved to UNIAC camp, which is just outside Harrogate. And at that time, I was appointed second in command. On the 26th of October, the brigade, which was then made up of the 6th and 8th DLI and a battalion of Queens who had been relieved in their brigade of 7th Armoured Division by 9th DLI. Anyway, the 6th DLI and the 8th DLI were ordered to provide a guard of honour for General Montgomery in Huddersfield, and I was given command of this guard of honour, and we did quite a bit of practice and went to Huddersfield on the day, and there was some confusion, I remember, because nobody quite knew where the general was. He was supposed to be approaching from some other town, and the police and that were keeping watch on him. But then he arrived, or very nearly arrived, somewhat unexpectedly, and he arrived just a few hundred yards away, but we managed to fall in the guard of honour in good time. And at the lunch afterwards, I should say before that, he inspected the gun honor very closely indeed. And as he always did, looking the men in their eyes with his steely grey eyes and asking them quite a lot of questions. And at the lunch afterwards in the town hall, he when he was given his scroll by the mayor and the council of the borough of Huddersfield, he was particularly complimented, and the delight it was, he said, to see these soldiers, which in well, certainly since Alamein. Anyway, then came Christmas 45, and that was our last Christmas in the army. We, you know, did the usual things. We had a jolly good dance ordered by, arranged by Ernie Cousins, who was a platoon commander in the battalion, as I've mentioned. And many men then were being demobilized, and we were packing up drafts and ordering drafts for overseas. By the 17th of January, 46, all our trainees had left us, and we had had a visit from the director of infantry to say that the battalion would probably go into suspended animation, as the term was, early in the new year. And in fact, this happened on the 16th of January. I was posted, the order came through on the 7th, I didn't leave till the battalion had gone on the 16th. I was posted to the 14th DLI, which had been a training battalion, and they were in Dorset, a place called Blandford. And I was posted to them as second in command. Things were winding down considerably by then. And in fact, then I went on release leave on the 7th of May, and later, I think, officially released from the army.
What was the process of release?
Well, it was a very efficient system, I think, in fact. And I think they'd learnt considerably from the experiences in 1918. But it was based on age and service. And the principle was that the older soldiers and those with most service were released first. I mean, for instance, we had an officer who had been in most of the war, and he was over 40, I think, and he was age and service group 3, which was very nearly the earliest of them. He went, and so on. And these age and service groups were calculated on this basis, and I don't know how many there were. I mean, there may have been over 100. And so that if you... well, of course, a young lad recently joined wasn't released at all till for quite some time afterwards, maybe a year, 18 months afterwards. But most of the DLI soldiers... I suppose were in 40 or 50 Asian service groups, something like that. As I say, it was actually August when I was released. And one was told to go to a particular point. I think I went to go to York, where you were issued with a civilian suit. And not a bad suit either, really. Shirt, underclothes, socks, and shoes, and I think they call it release bounty. I may have a record somewhere, but I can't just recollect for the moment. I think it was £50 I received.
Were you given a medical?
Yes. Yes, that's certainly a point. Yes, indeed. I think everybody was fairly closely examined. Certainly, perhaps slightly more thorough than very often medicals were, to establish, of course, whether later on whether anyone was claiming disability through war service. And I was asked about the wounds I'd had. But no, the whole business was went really without a hitch. Certainly, as far as people in Europe was concerned, I think in the Far East they had some trouble because the soldiers thought they were being delayed too long.
Before we go further, Major, to go back to Giel or Giel, it's reputed to have been quite a severe battle. Where does it lie in your hierarchy of severe actions that you were in?
Well, it was a peculiar battle, really, Giel, because it was extremely confused. No set order about it, and it was a rather fluid battle in that while we were trying to advance, the Germans were trying to advance, we were to some extent thrown off balance by the fierceness of the German reaction, having been told that there probably wasn't going to be a lot of opposition. And units and subunits were very much thrown on their own initiative, and one had to get forward with one's own weapons without any big battalion or brigade plan. And from that angle, it was a very difficult battle. There were quite a lot of casualties. But there wasn't the intense shell fire and mortar fire and reasonably close quarter battles with the infantry had been, for instance, at Saint-Pierre. And in my mind, certainly not as far as Marathe. I think Marathe was the worst action battle I was in. Followed, I suppose, by Alamein and probably Saint-Pierre. But it was a difficult battle, Giel, and I suppose one of the other things was that we were thrown from what appeared to be complete peace, really, in the luxury of the Belgian hospitality. I mean, a few hours later, we were being shot at crossing the Albert Canal. So it was a difficult battle, but one that was very confused, but in the end successful.
The men that you were leading at this time, you've mentioned CSM Brown. What was he like? He was wounded at Giel, wasn't he?
Yes, well, CSM Brown had been in 14th DLI. You will recall that Sergeant Major Ranson, my company Sergeant Major, had been killed at Marathe. And I'm not certain who was the D Company Sergeant Major in Sicily, as I wasn't there. But Brown volunteered for one of the units of the DLI going to Normandy, and he was sent to the 8th. And he was an extremely good man indeed. He was, for infantry warfare in Europe, he was perhaps better trained than most of us. And had tremendous help. And he quickly got to know the chaps. And there's no doubt that he was the company sergeant major, and he was a big loss, actually, after he went. But I followed 2 or 3 days afterwards, so we went out of the thing together. But there were other good NCOs too. The Lance Arnold Richmond I mentioned. He went through. He got a military medal for his action in at Saint-Pierre, and we had a number of NCOs, fairly good veterans, really.
You mentioned, I believe, Wallbank.
Yes, well, Warbank again was one of the best. Now, I'm not quite certain when he joined. He may have been in Sicily. He certainly wasn't in Battalion Marath. And he, I think, was from the Somerset Light Infantry. Very good chap. He was brave too, and but a good leader, and he'd done very well, and all the way through Le Plessis Grimaud too, and quite off and on, he was commanding a platoon as much as he was a platoon sergeant, and he was a big loss when he was killed at Guille.
Any of your officers particularly stand out in your memory?
Well, I mentioned Morrison, the Canadian. He was obviously going to make a very good platoon commander, and he was during the attack at the Plessis Grimaud. I watched him particularly. He was very good leading his men forward till he was wounded, and Lieutenant Bruce Wyatt too was another reinforcement that we had after Saint Pierre. And he settled down, not quite certain, don't think he was DLI, certain which regiment he came from, and he settled down to be a very good platoon commander indeed. And particularly the attack that I thought he did very well there. And again, during the crossing of the Albert Canal, he was very good, and he didn't mess about, you know, asking for. He reported to company headquarters and just said he was getting on with it, and he did, and his own training did the rest. And he was a loss when he was hit. But, I mean, the quality varied, and of course, one of the problems was in many cases is that the best people get hit, and we were beginning to notice it, and I think it became more obvious later on. The quality of the reinforcements wasn't up to what we'd been used to.
Was it shortly after the war, Major, that you and your colleague decided to write the battalion Second World War?
Well, no, it was rather earlier than that. I think a number of us had come to conclusion more or less independently that some record ought to be made, and if it was going to be made, it ought to be done fairly soon. So during the last few days at Harrogate, we got together, maybe about eight of us, I think, who'd been in the battalion for varying lengths of time, mostly a fairly good time. And with one of these, of course, was Captain, as he then was, Peter Lewis, who was a journalist. He had been involved. He was, when he got out of the prison camp he was in Italy, he, having jumped a train, there's quite a good story there, but he got into Switzerland and ran a British Army newspaper in Switzerland for those British who were interned. But we went roughly and went through all the various phases of the war and thought that who could write about this and who could write about that, and we got a list out of people who could give accounts of various actions and various periods. And then, as soon as we'd settled down after the war, sort of late 46 and 47, we wrote round to all these people and said, will you please do so-and-so, and began to collect these accounts together. He did several, of course, and so did I, and we had accounts from, I think, altogether about 16 contributors of various lengths and quality. And then between us, he did most of it, I think. We started to rewrite them, and put them into some coherent whole. We then found, of course, that we had about twice as much material as was going to go into a book, and ruthless cutting had to take place, in many cases rewriting. But by 1949, we'd got most of it into some sort of order. And we were then able to send a orderly room quartermaster Sergeant Harper, who had been at records office during the war in Ankara and later in England, to Exeter for the records. We were particularly keen on getting the Roll of Honour right, and also a list of awards and decorations. And so that took a little bit of time. We were engaged, of course, with, as was inevitable, with proofreading and so on. We got General Horrocks to write a foreword. In the meanwhile, we were still puzzling as to printers and what the thing was going to cost. And after getting maybe half a dozen quotations from various printers, even at that time we were appalled at the cost. And the honorary colonel of the 8th, who was Colonel John Turnbull, he came forward with the idea that there was a Turnbull fund, which certainly most of us had never heard of, from money that had been left to the battalion by, I think, his sister or aunt, and various other sources. And he said, we will use this to produce the history. We got Beals, eventually, of Newcastle to be the printer. And to the best of my knowledge now, without reference, we printed 1,500 in paperback and 500 in hardback. And really about it, in all various Northeast papers. And we sold them pretty quickly. I was always worried, because even in 1939 they were still trying to sell the 8th Battalion history from the First War. And they were landed with these blessed things. And I was awfully frightened that we would have the same position with this book. But anyway, it was very much the reverse. And quite honestly, I wish we'd had doubles. Even now we're being asked to, have you got a copy? And they're excessively rare.
Did you become involved with the Territorials after the war, Major?
Yes, the Territorial Army was reactivated in, I think I'm right in saying, 1948. And the 8th DLI and the 151 Brigade was reformed. And the 8th was put in the good hands of Lieutenant Colonel George Wood, who'd been right through with the 9th and also with the 6th. And we quickly got 200 or 300 in, and we heard afterwards that we were 24 hours notice to move when the siege of Berlin was on. But we didn't know that at the time, fortunately. And they went on from there. And of course, later on they were merged, and it's now the 7th Battalion of the Light Infantry. I remained with the 8th, mainly as second in command, because I had difficulty in taking command, because I lived in Cheshire from 1949 onwards. And I was either second in command or training officer, and retired in late in 1960.